my pleasure this afternoon to introduce our speaker, who is a member of our appellate team, Patricia Murphy-Profiter. She's practiced law in the area of child welfare for over 10 years. After teaching exceptional children for 8 years, she went to Wake Forest University School of Law with the intention of becoming a child advocate. Since then, she has practiced in the areas of domestic violence, public benefits, and dependency law. She was the first managing attorney for the Domestic Violence and Public Benefits Unit at the Legal Aid Society of Northwest North Carolina, a senior attorney for Child Welfare Legal Services, Department of Children and Families in Palm Beach County, Florida, and currently is part of the appellate team for the statewide Guardian Ad Litem program in Florida. She is going, as you know from the material, she's going to be discussing various TPR issues. And with that, I will hand it over to Patty.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here today. And as the materials that I sent out stated, I'd like to talk about a couple of issues today that we've seen coming up on appeal that are important. Since the appellate team started almost a year ago, of course, we've seen lots of different appeals or different issues on appeal, both procedural and substantive. However, I can't discuss all of those today, but one particular issue, the issue of single-parent TPRs, we're seeing more frequently, and currently there's some controlling case law out of the Second District Court of Appeal that we should all be aware of. I'm going to spend most of the time, therefore, talking about single-parent TPR cases. And then I will also talk about voluntary surrenders at the end. Again, so please just hold any questions or comments that you have at the end, and hopefully we'll be able to do a little bit of brainstorming as well. Single-parent terminations. As we all know, in termination of parental rights cases, there are three essential elements that must be proved by clear and convincing evidence. This applies to any termination case. The first is proof of at least one ground for termination pursuant to Section 39806 of the Florida statutes. The second essential element is proof that termination promotes the manifest best interest of the child, and that's pursuant to Section 3910 of the statute. The third is proof that termination is the least restrictive means to protect the child from serious harm. All of these elements must be included in the pleadings, must be proved at trial, and the trial court must make corresponding findings of fact as to each element. And again, this applies to all termination cases. Depending, though, on the particular facts of a case, there may be other elements that must also be established. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Again, it's a single-parent TPR or single-parent termination cases. Single-parent TPRs are allowed pursuant to Chapter 39, but only under very specific circumstances. Under Section 39811(6) of the Florida statutes, a single-parent termination is allowed, but only if the child has only one surviving parent, and I will talk about each of these in detail in just a minute. The identity of a prospective parent has been established as unknown after sworn testimony. The parent whose rights are being terminated became a parent through a single-parent adoption. The protection of the child demands termination of the rights of the single parent, or the parents whose rights are being terminated meet any of the criteria specified under 39806, which are the grounds for termination, and specifically under 1D, 1F, and through I. Okay? So these are the only circumstances under which a court should be able to terminate one parent without terminating the rights of another parent. It's important to note that these requirements under 811.6 are additional requirements. They have to be proved in addition to the essential elements that I talked about above. One ground for termination, the manifest best interest, and the least restrictive means. Also, the trial court must make specific findings of fact in the final order for all single-parent termination cases. However, there is some case law that states that at the very least, if the circumstances that establish one or more of the factors under 811.6 is apparent in the face of the order, even though there are not specific findings, the appellate court can still affirm the trial court's order as a single parent termination. And again, I will talk about that in a little more detail below. What I'd like to do is just go through those factors and just talk briefly, especially about the first three, because I think that those would not be that difficult to establish. For example, if the child has only one surviving parent, evidence of that can easily be produced at trial, and through a death certificate that could be entered into evidence, sworn testimony, that one should not be very difficult. But it is very important that it is part of the record. One of the biggest problems that we have on appeal is that a lot of information that is very important to the case is not put into the record for one reason or another. And unless it's in the record, we can't use it in the appellate case. So it's very important that if you have the death certificate, that you actually enter it into evidence. The second one is that the identity of a prospective parent has been established as unknown after sworn testimony. And if you look at Section 39803 of the Florida statutes, it goes through the inquiry that the trial court should make if this is the situation, if the identity or location of a parent is unknown. One of the points I'd like to make about that is I know that in some cases, in many cases, they may, when they start the dependency case, not the termination, there may only be one parent that's known, and there may be a diligent search going on for an unknown father, for instance. If that's the case, it's very important for any attorney, any party, to try to move that along so that you don't get to the termination phase of the case if reunification is not appropriate, and find that you still don't have the information that you need to establish that that prospective parent is unknown, pursuant to 803. Otherwise, you're just setting the case up for potential reversal and delayed permanency for the child because it would have to proceed as a single parent termination. And it may not be that the other that a factor is relevant in that particular case. So it's very important to be diligent from the very beginning when the children are first brought into care about the identity of any unknown or prospective parent. A third factor under the single parent termination statute is that the parent whose rights are being terminated became a parent through a single parent adoption. Again, supporting documentation, sworn testimony should be enough to establish that that is the case. The last two factors under Section 39811 provide a little more detailed analysis. One, which is D, the protection of the child demands termination of the rights of a single parent. Obviously, the evidence must support this finding, and it's important that during the trial that the facts that support this finding are brought out. It's also important that the pleadings include this information, that it's going to be a single-parent termination. There's not a whole lot of case law regarding single-parent terminations in general. I was able to find one case, which is SS versus L, and it's in the outline, which spoke specifically about this provision D, that the protection of the child demands termination. Unfortunately, that case was not helpful in establishing what would be enough to meet this prong, to meet D, but it did indicate was not enough to meet D. And frankly, what the court said in that case was that the evidence did not support termination of father's parental rights on the ground that termination was needed for the protection of the children. In that particular case, it was the guardian ad litem that testified that the father's past crime of sexual battery that was committed on a child's friend, warranted protection of the children. However, the court found that the guardian ad litem presented only speculation that this would cause the children future harm. and basically said the guardian had only spent 1 hour on the phone with the father, had not conferred with anyone else, and it just was not enough to show that the protection of the child demanded it. So while that may not be helpful because it won't be on point as far as what is enough, at least it gives some guidance as to what is not enough to show that the protection of the child demands the single parent termination. Just as a side note, of course, the cases that I'm going to talk about have other issues in them and deal with other important issues, and I hope that everybody will read them. But I'm just going to focus on the particular issues that have to do with the single parent termination cases. Okay. And I'm going to talk about D a little bit more also as we move down. The last factor under 811 is that the parent whose rights are terminated or being terminated meets any of the criteria specified in 39 806 1D or 1F, 1G, 1H, or 1I. Now, in the outline, I put down the various provisions from the statute. I'm not going to go through them specifically, but I will touch on each of them just briefly. 39-806-1D, that's the incarceration provision. And so basically what the statute is saying is that if the parent whose rights are being terminated, the single parent, if the court found that 39-806-1D existed grounds to terminate under that provision, then that would also meet the single parent termination statute. One thing I would like to point out is the time that you should be considering, where it says the period of time for which the parent is expected to be incarcerated will constitute a substantial portion of the period of time before the child will attain the age of 18 years. You start that time at the date that the TPR petition is filed, not at the time that the parent was incarcerated. There is one case that I don't actually have the site for right in front of me, but where the parent was going to get out of prison 1 month after the TPR petition was filed or after the TPR hearing was concluded, and the court said that was the time to consider it from, not from the 7 years prior or so that he had been in prison. Okay, so we have 806-1D incarceration. That's pretty clear cut if you can meet that. 806-1F, that's the egregious conduct provision. And basically, again, if the court finds that the parent who's right, you're trying to terminate under a single parent termination, if the court has found by clear and convincing evidence that that parent has engaged in egregious conduct, then you would be meeting one of the circumstances under 811. Now, there is also a case out of the 4th District Court of Appeals. It's from December of 2005. In this case, it's basically, it's an egregious conduct case. The mother had, I believe, 5 children. The children came into the department's care after one child was found dead and wrapped in a bag in the back of the house. The child had died of starvation. And the 4 other children basically were ordered into protective care, and it was shown that they received no medical care and were malnourished. The trial court there did determine that DCF proved by clear and convincing evidence that the mother engaged in egregious conduct, and so therefore met section 39-806-1F and 39-811-6E. So that's the grounds for termination and the grounds under the single parent statute. However, in this case, and this goes back to the very first elements that I talked about when I started, that the court must find that proof of at least one ground for termination, which the court did find here. He found 39-806-1F. However, the second essential element, proof that termination promotes the manifest best interest of the child, the trial court in that case, the case of KF, or DCF versus KF, the trial court did not find by clear and convincing evidence that it was in the manifest best interest of the children to terminate parental rights, and concluded that the least restrictive means of protecting the children was long-term relative custody with the grandmother. Now, the district court reversed the trial court's decision and found that it was in the manifest best interest and it was the least restrictive means, that termination. But the reason I bring this case up to you is because I don't want anyone to forget that even if you meet the requirements under the single parent statute, that you still have to go back and make sure that you're meeting the three essential elements of any termination case, because those are just as important, and you need to make sure that, that you can show that it is in the manifest best interest of the children or child, and that it is the least restrictive means of protecting the child. Okay? 39-8061C, aggravated child abuse, sexual battery, or sexual abuse, or chronic abuse, and 39-8061H, murder or voluntary manslaughter. Again, those can be established, and, you know, as long as you make sure that you enter whatever evidence you have regarding those into the record. I don't really have much to say about those. I think they're fairly self-explanatory. Now, 39-8061I, previous involuntary TPR, again, that is one of the grounds that the court will consider for a single-parent termination. And I think, again, that that's fairly clear. You know, either there has been one or there hasn't. Just make sure that the information gets into the record. Okay? I'm going to move on now to some of the more common issues regarding this particular issue that we see on appeal. First, and there are other cases out there, older cases, but the recent trend is what we're most concerned with, so I'm going to be dealing with more of the recent cases. One of the common issues that we see on appeal is the failure of the petitioner to allege or prove the statutory factors pursuant to 39-8116. In fact, in the case, a recent case, AG versus Department of Children and Families, I have the site there in the outline. That case, although it was dismissed because the court found that the issues brought by the parent were moot, the Second District Court of Appeal, in a footnote, provided some information that everybody really needs to pay attention to. And I'm going to read it to you, just part of it, because I think it's important. The court stated, the failure to address whether one of the circumstances in Section 39-8116, Florida statute, exists, has been the sole basis for reversal in several termination cases, and would have been in this case had the prospective father's rights not been terminated. We emphasize to trial courts and to all parties participating in termination proceedings the importance of heeding the statutory provision in cases where only one parent's rights are terminated. They go on, but I'm going to stop there because basically in this case, the trial court would have reversed this case, I believe, except that during the pendency of the appeal, I believe at oral argument, the department indicated to the court that the two fathers' rights had actually been terminated by that time. And so therefore, AG, the mother's issue that the court failed to address Section 39-811 was moot. But the court felt strongly enough that they put this whole footnote in. And the other part of it that is very relevant to us is that the court went on to state, even in cases in which the rights of both parents are terminated, trial courts may find it appropriate to address whether any of these circumstances are present as a precaution against the possibility that one parent's termination is reversed on appeal. And that's important because that, in fact, has been happening. And that's probably the most troubling trend that we're seeing in these cases. Another problem that we're seeing is the failure of the trial court to make the specific finding regarding the statutory factors pursuant to the single-parent statute. The second DCA, and again, most of these cases come out of the second DCA, has held that if there are no findings in the termination order that meet the circumstances laid out in 39811-6 regarding single-parent terminations, or, and this is important also, if the circumstances are not apparent on the face of the order, the appellate court will reverse the case and remand it to the trial court to make the required findings. So in the cases where the trial court doesn't make the specific findings, or there is a saving grace there that if the circumstances are apparent on the face of the order, and what that means is that the trial court actually did terminate based on one of the grounds that are listed under 39811, then the second district court of appeal, at least, is reversing the case and remanding it to the trial court to make required findings. That doesn't mean that the termination won't ultimately occur. It does mean that permanency has been unnecessarily delayed, and proactive behavior on the part of all the parties at the trial level could avoid that. And, of course, that's what's in the best interest of the child. Now, there's one case, it's called In Re ED, and there the paternal rights of the father were not terminated, and the action to terminate mother's rights proceeded as a single-parent termination, but the petition nor the evidence produced at trial alleged any of the circumstances described in 39811-6, and there the second DCA reversed the termination. So they really mean it, basically. They're going to be doing this, and they are doing this. However, as to the second part where the circumstances are apparent on the face of the order, in the case of In Re Dad II, the trial court found that the department proved grounds for termination under 8061F and G, and because those fall squarely within the scope of 39811-6E, the district court was able to affirm the trial court's order only because it was evident on the face of the order that the grounds were met. So that's sort of the saving grace, but it's better not to rely on that happening, especially if you do have the grounds that fall under. A more difficult issue, of course, is where you don't have, where the parents whose rights are being terminated does not fall within one of those enumerated grounds under 806, and that's where, and if it doesn't apply to the others where there's only one surviving parent or the parent's identity is unknown, or the other parent, or the parent became a parent through a single parent adoption, then you're basically left with D, which is the protection of the child demands it. And again, there's not much out there that tells us what's going to be enough and what's not going to be enough. Later when we're discussing the cases, I do have one where the trial court was able to, they made specific findings that the protection of the child demanded it. And that's a big help, because if that's in the trial court's order, then of course you have the trial court as the finder of fact making that determination, and his findings should be given great weight as long as they're supported by the evidence. So that's a little bit more difficult to show, but it's also at least a more general and more vague determination than any of the other ones. So if you don't fit into one of the other provisions, then at most try to put in there that the protection of the child demands termination, and try to make sure that the evidence you're producing at trial and that you're getting on the record supports that proposition. Okay, I'm going to see how I'm doing on time here. Now, the biggest issue that I wanted to bring up, of course, is where the reversal of the order terminating parental rights as to one parent in the appellate court. What's happening is it's a two-parent TPR, and both parents' rights are terminated at trial, but on appeal, one of the parents' rights are reinstated. The appellate court says there's not enough evidence to terminate, say, father's rights. What happens, at least in the second district, is that automatically turns the termination as to the other parent, in my mother, into a single parent termination. And then the court says, unless one of the grounds under 811.6 is already in the order, or is at least is evident by on the face of the order, if that was one of the grounds that, say, the mother's rights were terminated on, then the court is reversing, not only as to the father, but they're reversing and remanding as to the mother as well, for the trial court to make determinations based on 811.6. And while that may be problematic, and it certainly would be for the attorneys, that is the prevailing law right now, and that is the law that we're required to follow under the conflict of laws. Basically, under the conflict of laws, is trial courts are required to follow the decision of district courts of appeals unless and until the district court of appeal for the district in which the trial court sits decides the issue to the contrary, or until the Supreme Court of Florida overrides or overrules the decision. So basically, as long as this is the prevailing law, and in this case it is, in the Second District Court of Appeal, that applies to all of the District Court of Appeals and the trial courts, unless they and until they come up with conflicting law, or until the Supreme Court overrules those decisions. So even if we don't particularly like the way the law is right now, this is what we're bound by, and so we need to proceed accordingly. The main case regarding that issue, where one parent is reversed on appeal and therefore subjecting the other parent to the provisions of 811.6, is In Re LC, also known as JT versus Department of Children and Families. And there, the second DCA held that because of the reversal of the mother's parental rights, the termination of the father's parental rights needed to be justified as single-parent terminations. The record in that case did not support termination of, there were two fathers, of either father's parental rights as single-parent terminations under 39811. The only ground for termination cited by the trial court, which would have, in fact, permitted a single-parent termination, was the incarceration ground. But that had already been separately rejected on appeal. So therefore, the court reversed and remanded. And there's another case, In Re VM. And there, the district court, the second district court, held that the trial court erred in terminating the father's rights. And therefore, even though the evidence supported termination of mother's parental rights, the reversal of father's termination invoked the requirements under 39811. That case was also reversed. They reversed mother's termination and remanded specifically so the trial court could make a proper decision under 39811.6. Now, I don't know what happens when they get to the trial court and if they cannot make those determinations, then obviously we have a problem in even further, longer delays in permanency. I'd like to talk about the implications for trials and orders, but I'd like to do that at the end of the conference call. So I'm going to move on to voluntary surrenders, although I don't have much on that. But just to recap, in these cases, both parents must be terminated concurrently, or the trial court must make specific findings justifying a single-parent TPR under 39811.6. One of the other issues, and that's why I put this with today's conference call, that might come up is where there are voluntary surrenders. As you know, under 39806.1a, the first ground that's listed as a ground for termination of parental rights is a voluntary surrender. Specifically, grounds for termination may be established when the parent or parents have voluntarily executed a written surrender of the child and consented to the entry of an order giving custody of the child to the department for subsequent adoption, and the department is willing to accept custody of the child. Okay, and this has come up in a couple of recent contexts. One is that it's important to note that it's the department who basically accepts the surrenders. While the court may accept the document, if the department is not willing to accept custody of the child, then the court should not be accepting the surrenders, because the statute is very clear that it's when the department is willing to accept custody of the child. Why this may present issues in single-parent terminations goes back to the fact that the parents really need to be terminated concurrently, for the same reason that if there's an identity unknown or a prospective parent whose identity is unknown, it's very important to try to take care of this from the beginning and make sure that everything proceeds accordingly. Otherwise, you get stuck, usually at the end of the TPR trial and when the case goes on appeal, where there's a single parent termination that nobody really expected and did not really plan for, and therefore did not plead or prove, and there are no findings. There is one case, at least recently, where the court accepted a surrender over the objection of the department and the gal, and the court did not actually terminate parental rights, because even if they accept the executed surrender, that does not mean that it's actually the termination is in effect, because remember, the surrender is the ground. That's under the grounds for termination. They still have to go through the other elements. So that's only the first one. And the court can find that the grounds under 1A have been met, but they also must find that it's in the manifest best interest of the child and that it's the least restrictive means to protect the child from harm to accept those surrenders. So these, just accepting the surrender at sort of a piecemeal termination does not work, and especially now that they are very aware and is looking for these single parent cases, because bear in mind, if one parent case, if they have accepted surrenders and have actually terminated that parent, and then the other parent is at termination stage, and they don't meet one of the circumstances as listed under 811, that to proceed as a single parent termination, then effectively that parent's case may not be able to go forward. So it's something to be aware of, and again, something to be following from the beginning of the dependency. I believe that the department's unlikely to accept the surrenders too early of a stage. Just for common sense reasons, it basically alleviates the surrendering parent from any duties and responsibilities regarding the child, such as case plan compliance. And then again, it'll set the other parent up for a single parent termination, which may or may not be relevant in that particular case. I just want also to point out, going back to the single parent termination cases, there are some cases where the court has found that even though the department or the petitioner has proved a ground under 806 and they have met the requirements of 39811, the single parent statute, they still have found that it's not in the manifest best interest or the least restrictive mean to terminate. This is particularly true in a case where the other parent may be working on a case. The reason for that is basically because then the child or children is left in a definite state of dependency and is not really ready for permanency. And so the court, at least in the case of HP versus DCF, found that it was not in the manifest best interest of the child to terminate the one parent, and that it was not the least restrictive means, at least and until the other parent either did or did not comply with their case plan. I see that I have about 20 minutes left, and I've covered most of my material. I would love to have some discussion on this and questions and answers, and I think that for a lot of it, I have attached a checklist for single-parent TPRs to the material, and that is just a suggestion. It's not anything that needs to be used. But it's just an idea as to how to go through these cases to make sure that you're covering all the essential elements for these particular cases. So if you want, we can move on to questions now.